This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Following the shooting of an African-American man by police in the Queen City, protesters take to the streets. Days of protests turn violent and police respond with tear gas. The violence and depth of frustration and anger surprise many, but not those in the black community, and there are angry calls for the resignation of key local leaders. Yes, that happened here in Charlotte last week, but it happened first in the other Queen City, Cincinnati, in 2001. When the dust settled there, Cincinnati took its first tentative steps toward change. One of the people involved in making those changes was that city's then-mayor, Charlie Lucan. We thought it would be interesting and important to see what we could learn from Cincinnati's experience, so Mayor Lucan joins us for part of the program today by phone. Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Mike.
It was, I believe, April 7th, 2001, that an unarmed black man named Timothy Thomas was shot and killed by a Cincinnati police officer, and the response to that shooting seemed far worse than what happened here last week. Can you summarize the events that followed?
The events that followed immediately were that people took to the streets in Cincinnati for 3 days of sometimes violent protests and a curfew. I called a curfew after three days. And the rioting subsided, but the aftermath lasted years, still is here today.
What took you so long? Our mayor has come in, our mayor and our police chief have been criticized here for not calling for a curfew until the second night. You took 3 days. What took so long?
Doesn't work sometimes when people are really agitated. I mean, if they are out in the streets doing various things, calling, saying they have to go home at 8 o'clock is not going to work. And so you have to find that space where the police and the community thinks you have a chance to be successful. And it was, but it, and I don't know, in hindsight, maybe a day earlier, you can look back on all these things and say, maybe you should have done this or that, but that was the thinking at the time.
Had there been a known history of police antagonism toward African-Americans in your city prior to that night? Was it known in the African-American community or perceived to be that way in the African-American community? Was it known in other parts of the city, like in the government, for instance?
Well, it was certainly known in the African-American community. And I remember a few months before the riots giving a state of the city and saying that the race relations in Cincinnati were the number one priority, and people thought, well, it's got to be economic development, or it's got to be this, or it's got to be that, and they were surprised to hear that. But if you looked at Cincinnati at that time, there had been a series of confrontations and deaths at the hands of police, and tensions were boiling. And the Timothy Thomas incident that you described was just the catalyst to get that kind of boiled it over.
This happened in your city before social media really had a chance to blossom into the force that it's become today. And it happened before the seemingly endless series of police-on-black shootings that have proliferated in the news of late. Did the protests and riots that followed that shooting in your city surprise leaders, citizens, the press?
Yeah, I'm sure it did. I think the depth or the length of them, the severity of them, surprised lots of people. I would imagine if you were talking to one of our community leaders at the time, they would say they were not surprised because things had gotten so bad and their concerns were not being addressed. And so like so many things, you see in Cincinnati at that time, a city divided, and some people thinking all's rosy with the world, and then a different perspective from a different part of the city. So I think it would depend on who you spoke to.
You said a minute ago that in your State of the City address prior to the shooting of Timothy Thomas, you said that the race relations was going to be the number one priority for the city of Cincinnati at the time. Timothy Thomas's death was the 15th African-American. He was the 15th African-American killed by Cincinnati police in the 6 years between 1995 and 2001. Did that, was that partly what provoked you to declare race relations?
Yeah, I mean, I would hasten to add that in 10 of those cases, police officers were being assaulted by a gun or a knife. But having said that, yes, some of these circumstances around these shootings were difficult and hard to explain. Mm-hmm. And this city had to undertake a real hard look at itself. There was no putting the genie back in the bottle. You know, the bottle was broken and the genie is gone. And we engaged in the most far-reaching collaboration in the history of this city with some of the most far-reaching and dramatic changes that the city's ever experienced. And I think both sides would tell you that our city is better for the exercise.
Hmm. We just had a very volatile city council meeting on Monday night.
Yes.
In which our leaders were shouted down by the crowd that was assembled there, and a lot of expletives were exchanged, etc. And according to a story in the Cincinnati Inquirer at the time that we're talking about in your city, the city council expected about 40 or 50 people to come to a meeting following Timothy Thomas's shooting. Hundreds showed up. They had protest signs reading "cop killers." Some were chanting "no justice, no peace." What was it about that shooting in your city at that time that finally caused the teapot to boil over?
It was almost like it was simmering, and when it happened and people began to voice their concerns and found people in similar circumstances, they came to City Hall, and you're right, there were hundreds, and we listened to each and every one of them, and I've seen some of the clips from Charlotte, and they look very similar to me. Ours might have been larger, but the way people behaved, the frustration, that was very much the same 15 years ago in Cincinnati.
Charlie Lucan is who we're talking to. He's the former mayor of Cincinnati, Ohio, and he was the mayor at the time of racial unrest that was provoked by the shooting of African-American people in the African-American community by police that boiled over on April the 7th, 2001. A lot of parallels between their story and ours. For instance, your city, like Charlotte, believed that it had made significant progress on racial issues since the 1960s, but in the aftermath of this particular shooting, protesters there, like those here, did not want to simmer down. They didn't want things to return to normal. They didn't want more talk. They wanted to shake things up. They wanted things to change. And things erupted as a result of that. How do you get a handle on that? When you look at the three days of violence,
Mike, what happened in Cincinnati, I mean, we went through these changes, but it took years, and it was difficult, and people said the worst things about one another. And at times, we kind of felt, last one out of the city, turn out the lights. It was a very tough 2 or 3 years, but at the end of it, we did some things that we had to do, and they've made the city better on just about every level imaginable. I don't know. I mean, I've been to Charlotte. It's one of America's great cities. People should be proud of what they've accomplished there, but it's hard for me to address exactly what should be done, yeah. But I will tell you one thing, if I might. And that is that the handling of the video was strange to me. I mean, the one thing that we learned above all was to get things like this out immediately. And I never understand what people think they're going to accomplish by keeping a video for 3 or 4 days or however long and saying it's under investigation. Look, ultimately that video's coming out. So what are you doing by trying to keep it in that? And when you do that, at least in my experience, that simply breeds distrust. A lot of the community thinks it's a game anyway, and the police are just trying to fix the system or fix the video while we wait. So we adopted one change, which is we get this stuff out there within 24 hours.
Hmm. You mentioned a second ago that in the painful years that followed, a lot of bad things were said to both sides to each other. Is that something you have to go through? Is that part of the healing process to get it out on the table? Tell people what you're thinking, what you're feeling, even if it hurts.
Yes, and sometimes the most outrageous things are said, and even those have got to be heard and listened to. And you know, a lot of times it's, you know, your mayor, I think they called for her to resign. They certainly called for me to resign. I think both sides called for me to resign. I think the police called for me to resign. I mean, everybody was calling for everybody to resign. I mean, that's very hurtful when you're trying to move a city forward. But those kinds of things, that the rhetoric was, and then we didn't have social media, but we have something called talk radio, which on both sides was just screaming. So, I look back on it and think, believe it or not, it was mostly healthy. I mean, Cincinnati would not be where it is today without going through a process that was painful.
It's very easy to stand on the sidelines and criticize the coach. And in this case, a lot of people were criticizing city officials for every move they took or did not take. I know that you faced the same decisions that our mayor and our police chief here were confronted with. You worried about being too aggressive in the face of the violence. You worried about what would happen if you imposed a curfew or called in the National Guard. You also feared not being aggressive enough. What did you do?
We didn't call in the National Guard, but we did get some highway patrol people to help our police. And I do think that the restoring law and order in those circumstances is the highest priority. But once that's done, the community has got to engage in a collaborative process. And what we did was I actually invited the Justice Department to come in to Cincinnati, and together with community activists, we engaged in a collaboration under the moderation of the federal court. We were not under a consent decree, but we voluntarily agreed to have a conversation under the guidance of the federal court. And, you know, after a few years, it produced something that is kind of our Bible in terms of police-community relations called the collaborative. And it still exists today, and it is still used as, for Cincinnati, it's still used as what we look to when we're deciding whether we're doing policing correctly.
There was a telling line in another story in the Cincinnati Inquirer that seemed very familiar. It read, "A city that preferred to keep its racial problems quiet was now the talk of the nation. A city that prided itself on law and order was now a symbol of chaos." That sentence could have been in the Charlotte Observer this morning. How long did it take for Cincinnati's image as a city to recover, not nationally?
Well, I think it probably 4 years. I mean, I'm just pulling that number out. It was a gradual thing, and we used the energy of change to not only look at policing, but to look at things like assisting minority businesses and poverty, and our relations with our LGBT community, and our Chamber of Commerce establishing Minority Business Accelerator. I mean, we used it as a catalyst to look at many issues dealing with how fair a community that we had. And I think that quote that you just read to me is pretty accurate.
We have to take a break. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the North Carolina Zoo, presenting Halloween Zoo Grooves, a 21 and over Halloween event October 15th at the zoo in Ashboro, featuring the Sleeping Booty Band. Tickets and more at nczoo.org/nczoogrooves. And Charlotte Latin School, committed to helping children become lifelong learners by educating the heart and mind, hosting an open house on October 7th for kindergarten and first grade. Kindergarten is the primary entrance point at Latin. Information at charlottelatin.org. Now, on our local news roundup tomorrow, Charlotte continues to be in the national news following the police shooting of Keith Scott. City Council was disrupted by protesters and the poignant sight of a young girl crying over mistreatment of African Americans by police. More heat on Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf over the fake account scandal, and Charlotte makes its way into this week's presidential debates. Those stories and more with our roundtable of reporters tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a new study from the World Health Organization says 92% of people breathe dangerously unhealthy air. Who's most affected? Long-term health consequences and efforts to improve air quality.
That conversation on the Diane Rehm Show following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to the former mayor of Cincinnati, Charlie Lucan, who was mayor when they had a situation in their city very much like what we've just gone through. The parallels are striking, actually, in many ways, not the least of which is that they are the Queen City in Ohio, and we are the Queen City here. Mr. Lucan, on the one side, you had very angry citizens, tired, angry, frustrated over years of what they perceived to be and what was in fact mistreatment by the police. On the other hand, you had frustrated police who also felt allegations of racism were baseless, and that if you try to – and this has happened across the country. We're going to talk about this in the next segment with our other guest. When you come in and you tell police that you can't do certain things – they feel as though you're not supporting them, their lives are on the line, and they feel that they're working with one or two hands tied behind their back. How do you bridge that gulf?
Well, it takes time, but I would point out that we had a terrible spike in crime immediately after the riots for about a year, and some people attributed that to the fact that the police retreated, and we could debate why that happened, but it was a pretty significant spike in crime for a year, and some people felt it was exactly what you said, which is the police felt that they were not being treated fairly, and clearly they did not. And, you know, 15 years have gone by, Mike, and I think the concept of policing has changed dramatically, not only in Cincinnati, but in other places. So I think we started from a place that's probably back from where Charlotte is today, because some of these community policing ideas over the last 15 years have become part of the fabric of what police do today.
But we've been involved in that. We've been doing community policing for quite a while, yep. And there have been these ex-government organizations or non-government organizations that have worked carefully with the police to try to bring them into at-risk neighborhoods and build relationships with people, and yet we still have this problem. You say you called in the Justice Department to look at your police department. What did they find?
Well, they never really found anything because we were doing it all voluntarily. I mean, we didn't ask them to come in and do an well, we kind of asked them to do an assessment, but more than look at the past, they worked with us on putting together things and say, mental health. We didn't have a citizens complaint authority. We didn't have cameras. There are a whole list of things that we did not. Our police chief could only be selected from the department. I mean, all these things, which Charlotte probably is way past, all of these things we adopted in short order, in addition to having a process. Now, you might have one of those in Charlotte. I don't know, but a process where both community activists, police, city, other interested parties actually sat at the table and ironed these things out collaboratively. Now, the way you're describing it, you may have all these things in place, and maybe what's needed is just to make sure they're working. I don't know, but I can tell you that just, again, from the way the video was handled, if we have a shooting in Cincinnati and we handle a video the way Charlotte did, we will have a similar reaction even today.
As you watch these videos from police altercations with African-Americans around the country, do you look at those and think, we don't do that here in Cincinnati? We may have done it in the past, but we don't do that anymore. We don't police like that anymore. Can you safely say that yet?
Yes. I mean, not in every case. I mean, if somebody's pointing a gun at a police officer, he's going to shoot them. Mm-hmm. But I can say, I can't say all cases, but I certainly have seen videos that I would say we do not do that in Cincinnati. And if, you know, if the occasional rogue shooting happens, and we did have one a few months ago by a University of Cincinnati police officer, there's a process, there's an indictment, there's a, you know, things happen. I'm not even passing on what happened in Charlotte, because I don't know. I mean, with the shooting, whether it was good or bad, I couldn't tell you, but I thought the way it was handled was not the most would not breed trust in the community.
Over time, you mentioned you developed something called the Collaborative. Is that separate from the Cincinnati Initiative to Reduce Violence?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, so the Cincinnati Initiative to Reduce Violence is part of the Collaborative. In other words, under the auspices of the Collaborative. Everything comes under the Collaborative and that comes under it.
And as I understand it, as part of that, there have been meetings with potential troublemakers between them and police and prosecutors where they all get together and they talk. What has been the outcome of that?
Well, I would say it's mixed, but I would say that in terms of the trust issue, it's much, much better. When I say it's mixed, we haven't solved the problem of violent crime in Cincinnati. I don't want to give you that impression. But I think on the trust quotient, things are very much improved. And identifying the people who are the bad guys or are headed, more importantly, I think headed in the direction of being the bad guys, and having a conversation with them has been part of the initiative. And I think that has worked rather well.
In the wake of what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, the Wall Street Journal published something called Five Lessons for Ferguson from Cincinnati's 2001 riots. And I want to see if you agree with them. First, they say, tell the public everything immediately. Otherwise, you'll be suspected of hiding something and trouble will ensue. You've already addressed that. Second, set the record straight, meaning that you make sure you correct mistakes in the media and in the minds of the public. Were there lots of people making assumptions in the media that were causing things to get out of hand more quickly or more worse or worse than they would have otherwise?
Well, yes, but I think in Cincinnati's case, the shooting itself was a little, we didn't have video, but I think that it was an unarmed 19-year-old man running away from a police officer. So, I mean, the facts of the shooting were not good, particularly when compounded by the things that have happened.
The third of those five lessons, don't crucify the cops.
Yeah. Well, I don't think people crucify the, you know, I think sometimes the police take criticism or attempts to change something as a criticism, and it's not meant that way. But if they feel criticized, a lot of times they will retreat.
Number four is the federal government can slow the healing. The Wall Street Journal alleges that following your riots, it tried to bully your police department into admitting civil rights violation, and it failed. Is that in fact what happened?
Well, I think if you talk to the police chief, he might say that, or he might argue with that. They certainly got a little heavy-handed on occasion, and part of the pain in the process was to balance what was fair, and even I thought sometimes the Justice Department overreached.
And finally, they say repudiate race baiters, meaning outside agitators who come into town to take advantage of a bad situation and then try to make it worse. Did you have a lot of that in Cincinnati during those riots?
Well, of course. I mean, everybody came to town, and unlike Charlotte, where these things are happening in many cities, we were the only game in town, so we had everybody in the world come, you know, you name the person, they were here. But I don't know if you repudiate them or just let them have their say and separately try to keep the focus on keeping the record straight.
Former Cincinnati Mayor Charlie Lucan with us to shed some, to bring us some, I guess, some ideas on what we can do to approach what we've just been through, which is very much what like they went through in 2001. Mayor Lucan, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And I like Charlotte. It's a great town and good luck.
Well, thank you. The shooting of Keith Lamont Scott by police on Tuesday of last week allowed tensions between, as obviously, the African-American community and law enforcement that had been simmering to boil over. And while officials call for calm and dialogue, others believe systemic change is what is needed and not just more talk. Mayor Jennifer Roberts has asked the Department of Justice to look at CMPD's use of force policies in other cities like Cincinnati. Federal investigations have led to reform. In fact, the Obama administration has been particularly aggressive when it comes to carrying out reforms, but have they been effective? Last year, the Washington Post looked into that and found mixed results. Kimberly O'Kelly is an investigative reporter with the Post and was part of the Pulitzer Prize-winning team looking into police reform, digging into decades of federal intervention of local police departments around the country. And she joins us now by phone to share some of what the Post discovered. Kimberly, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We obviously just finished speaking to former Cincinnati Mayor Charlie Lucan, who was in office in 2001 when their city erupted into violence over police behavior toward their African-American community. They worked to change things. Assuming that your research looked into that city, have they done over the years to improve things?
In Cincinnati or just
In Cincinnati.
I don't have the information about Cincinnati in front of me, but in general, there are mixed results in terms of the departments that have changed over the years. And sometimes you see the use of force go up, and sometimes you see it go down. And the complaints also fluctuate. But one of the things that's very consistent across the board is that these changes can change with a police chief coming and going with efforts when the federal monitor, there's a federal monitor that usually is put in place for investigative reforms, some of them, not all of them. And if there's an oversight person in place, sometimes you'll see a lot more change during that period than, you know, during the period in which they leave. But we found that it wasn't consistently. You couldn't say if a police department or a city went through a reform over 4 years or over 10 years that necessarily their use of force dropped dramatically.
Why did the Washington Post decide to devote its resources to investigating police department practices and reforms around the country?
That's an interesting question. After Ferguson, we found that the numbers that had been kept on officer-involved shootings, we had some concerns about that, and so we started tracking them. So shortly after the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson in August 2014, the Post created a database of fatal police shootings, and we ended up finding out that last year there were nearly 1,000 people who were killed by officers who were on duty, and we found some interesting disparities, that number was actually double what the federal government had been tracking from police departments that had been self-reporting that data.
How can that be? How can the government be so far off from what you discovered?
Well, as I mentioned, they're self-reported, so not all agencies were required to include that information. So you had police departments that were reporting it, and then you had others that were not.
So of the 1,000 people that you've discovered who were killed in police situations, were they mostly police on African-American? Do they run the gamut? Were they justified? How would you describe them?
I mean, they run the gamut in terms of race. But one of the things that we did find is, obviously, a large, when you look at the raw numbers of those who were killed by police officers, you know, the race of those people were white. But when you factor in a rate that's compared by the race of the population where these folks were killed, you actually see a different picture, a very different picture emerge. And what we saw were that African Americans were actually 2.5 times more likely to be killed by an officer than somebody who was white when you looked at that rate. And in 2016, half of the victims were white and half were minorities. And particularly when you drill down even further and you look at African-American men, we found that in 2015 that even though they made up 6% of the population, they comprised 40% of all the unarmed people who were shot.
So let's be clear about this. You're saying that black people are more likely to be shot and killed by police around the country in altercations or in confrontations.
When you look at the rate, absolutely. I mean, unarmed black men were 6 times as likely as unarmed whites to die from police gunfire. I mean, that's one of the findings that we found. And we, you know, looked at public records kept by police departments. We looked at articles in newspapers and publicly available information that was out there, and we just kept tracking it. And so this is our second year. And so, yes, without a doubt, we saw definite racial disparities. And when you look at the aggregate number, and I do want to emphasize that the raw number shows that whites are the greatest victims, but you have to look at that rate as well to see if there are any disparities, and there were.
So this may be outside the scope of your investigation at the Washington Post, but did you look into why it may be that the ratio is 2.5 times higher for African Americans than for whites? Is it purely racism? Is it because the police were patrolling in what would be considered to be dangerous neighborhoods? Is it because the people being shot did not comply with police orders, or because they were in fact armed? Did we look into any of that? Do we know why? What the underlying cause of all this might be?
I think if somebody could clearly answer that question, they would get a lot of business in the coming years. I think one of the things that we were able to look at were the circumstances about, you know, were people armed, were they unarmed? And like I mentioned, just the number, when you look at those who were unarmed, that blacks were still 6 times more likely. But to answer the why, I don't think people can point to one specific reason. One of the things that did emerge that a lot of people were unfamiliar with was the pattern that we found around mental illness. We found that 1 in 4 of the incidents actually involved somebody who was in some sort of mental health crisis at the time. And that's a pretty large number to have 1 in 4 incidents. And I think particularly over the last year, as you see the footage of cell phone videos, you see that playing out in instances where some people are armed and some are unarmed. And that is something that even mental health experts are taking especially a note of, because those numbers were not available before. And so I think, to answer your question, I think that there are disparities around race, but that they may not have a clear explanation why that's occurring. But then there are also other disparities that are like the mental illness
right.
issue that is of a huge concern to people who are studying this issue.
So does that tell us then that we need more access to mental health treatment, and that police need to be better trained with regard to dealing with mental health individuals, or at least in de-escalating situations before they get out of hand?
I think when you talk to experts, they would probably say all of the above. They would say that some police departments are actually really good with dealing with mental health crisis. They have CIT trainers who, when you suspect that that's a case that you're getting called out on, there are certain people who are called out who can de-escalate, who have an expertise in that area. And then there are other police departments that may not have people who are trained in that. And so what you have is them going out on a call, and, you know, these are police officers. They're not mental health experts. They're taught to, you know, try to de-escalate, but then also to contain the situation. And so their training is very different for going out on a regular day-to-day basis to stop and try to prevent crime. And so what you do see is a call from mental health experts and also police experts and leaders to try to get more training around mental health cases. But what I also find is experts are saying...
Let me stop you there. You can say it after the break, because we have to take a break, Kimberly. Kimberly Kelly is an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and SunTrust Bank, providing tools and information to help people take a step toward financial confidence. SunTrust Bank member FDIC. And Charlotte Ballet, presenting fall works featuring 2 ballets to celebrate artistic director Jean-Pierre Bonfou's 20th anniversary, October 20th through 22nd at Knight Theater. Tickets at charlotteballet.org. The Senate overrides President Obama's veto of a bill that would allow 9/11 victim families to sue Saudi Arabia. How those lawsuits might work, the topic of the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. Our Charlotte Talks is hosting a special public conversation to address last week's police shooting and the protests that followed. You're invited to join us for Building Trust. Where does Charlotte go from here? Tuesday night, October 4th, 7 to 9 at the McGlohan Theater. You can register at WFAE.org.
James Mina, General Director, Principal Conductor of Opera Carolina, a WFAE underwriter. From the very beginning, we recognized that WFAE was the place to be to gain support and a reach to an audience. So at least for 16 years, and I'm sure for much longer than that, WFAE has been a great partner for Opera Carolina.
Email underwriting at WFAE.org for information.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Kimberly O'Kelly in this segment. She's an investigative reporter, part of a Pulitzer Prize-winning team at the Washington Post who investigated police activities around the country and police departments around the country. And we've just discovered that African-Americans are 2.5 times more likely, at least according to the police departments they looked in, to be shot and killed by police officers in the line of duty. And we talked about mental health problems, et cetera, and that being part of the problem. And you were saying that experts were also saying that, and I had to interrupt you at that point, Kelly.
Sure. Mental health experts also talk about whether police in general should be handling these calls. I mean, police officers will tell you, you know, they may not be trained in this arena. And if there's if you're having a mental health crisis, you know, is the best solution to pick up, to have a police officer come there and address the issue? You know, largely what's happening is these people are getting, you know, arrested and maybe taken to, you know, a jail before a mental health hospital or something like that. But, you know, is it the role of a police officer to address a mental health crisis? And I think that that's a conversation that's happening now, both in police departments and with mental health experts across the country, and trying to be able to solve what is the best way to handle these emergencies, especially now that you have numbers documenting that this is a big problem.
Although I said at the beginning of this segment, the Obama administration has been particularly aggressive in looking into police departments, the Justice Department's attempt to overhaul police departments around the country predate the Obama administration. They go back 2 decades, in fact. And yet for many non-African Americans, the need for reform has come as a surprise. Were these reform attempts all aimed at correcting racial disparities, or were there other things that the Justice Department was going after?
That's an excellent question. I mean, there are a lot of things that they're looking at. They're looking at excessive force. They're looking at racial profiling. They're looking at all sorts of civil rights violations. This is not just about, you know, racial disparities. And so you do have a huge bucket. And depending on what department the Department of Justice is investigating, which police department across the country, you see a variety of issues. I mean, there are some departments where the LGBT population is being targeted unfairly. And that's something that the Department of Justice has pointed out in its investigation and is requiring for police departments to reform. You look at Baltimore, the most recent results of their most recent investigation, and you see a myriad of issues involving people that aren't just because they're African American. And so, as you point out, the Department of Justice has been investigating police departments for well over 2 decades, since I believe 1994. And we all remember, well, most of us, I think, Rodney King, and we you know, the videotape beating of Rodney King out in L.A. by officers. And that was really the tipping point back then of what prompted these federal reforms, which essentially allowed, where Congress empowered the Department of Justice to investigate not just a police officer, but an entire police department for civil rights violations, to go in, to investigate, to come up with findings, and then, if warranted, force a reform through a federal judge. And that's what you're seeing happening in the course of the last 20-something years since 1994, the Department of Justice has investigated over 60 police departments in that time. Now, that could seem like a very small number, particularly when there are 18,000 police departments across the country. But what the Department of Justice is trying to do is look at different things in terms of civil rights violations with different police departments, hoping that they can set the standard and the tone for what is a constitutional best practice, and that other police departments, to prevent them from being investigated, will say, hey, well, let me take a look at Baltimore. Let me take a look at the reforms that are happening in New Orleans. Let me see what the Department of Justice imposed there, and let me try to implement those reforms maybe in my police department before I'm threatened with a lawsuit by DOJ.
The Post reports that reforms have, in fact, led to modernized policies, new equipment, better training. But you also say, and you said this at the very beginning of our conversation, outcomes are mixed. In fact, you say that in 5 of 10 police departments, the use of force by officers increased during and after policy changes suggested by justice were put into place. It stayed the same or declined in the other 5. How do you explain that?
Well, there's a couple of ways you can explain it. One, maybe you didn't get better. So maybe the numbers are increasing because the reforms didn't stick. Right. You have police departments, and I believe Detroit is a good example, and so is Puerto Rico right now. They're undergoing a 10-year reform. But the Detroit Police Department was supposed to go into, I believe it was either a 4 or 5-year reform, and it ended up doubling. And so essentially the reform took almost 11 years. It was like a 10-year reform. And you had can't remember exactly, but it's about like 7 police chiefs that they cycled through during the course of that reform. So imagine your police department. You have the Department of Justice breathing down your neck saying you must reform. These are the measures. And then you cycle through almost a police chief every other year. You know, how do you make those changes stick? And so I think you have some police departments that have struggled with that. And so that impacts their numbers. But then what you also have is use of force is defined differently from police department to police department. In one police department, force, and a lot of people don't know this, force could be an officer handcuffing you. Force in another police department is an officer even reaching for their gun. In another police department, it's an officer unholstering their gun. And so what you saw when Department of Justice came in and police departments began reform, they first had to define what is use of force. And so you saw that definition change. And so when you saw that being defined, all of a sudden police officers now have to start tracking things differently. So more things may be defined as force than were previously. And so you may see an increase in the numbers. But what experts will tell you is you will see an increase in those numbers as police departments start to define that new definition and rank and file start reporting on that. So for about a few years, you'll see those numbers increase, not necessarily because there's more force, but because there's a different definition of force. Now, after that introductory time period, experts will say you should see that number start to go down.
So what I'm hearing you say is that as the Justice Department gets involved, there becomes a standard definition for certain things that had disparate definitions. Should there be, from what you've learned, should there be some sort of national standard on when the use of force is acceptable?
I knew that was going to be your next question because that has been a question debated for years, both at the federal and local level. And what I heard in my reporting essentially is, and there have been attempts to actually create a federal standard, but there's been a lot of pushback, particularly from what I understand at the local level. You know, police departments want to maintain control at a local level, and they have a variety of reasons for wanting to do that. But also, different police departments have different issues. Like we talked about earlier, some have issues with, you know, disparate treatment of the gay population. Some have disparate treatment of racial minorities. Some have disparate treatment around victims of sexual assault. So there are a variety of different civil rights issues that police departments may be facing. And so a one-size-fits-all rule, some local authorities say, does not help police departments necessarily. It kind of pins them into something that may not necessarily benefit them. But at a federal level, absolutely, you have experts saying we need to have a clear-cut standard that police departments can say this is the basic level of definition of force. And not only this, let's start reporting these numbers so we can see how prevalent this is across the country.
In the departments in which the Post looked at, in which you report that officer morale plummeted in the face of reforms, were they the departments where perhaps the reforms were most needed, or was that not the case?
I don't think you necessarily know where reforms are most needed. One of the things that, you know, when I first started looking into this issue, I think there's a natural assumption by folks to think that if the Department of Justice investigated you, if there are 18,000 police departments and you're one of the 67 that in 20-something years got investigated, you are the worst of the worst in the United States of America. And what I ended up finding out that that wasn't necessarily the case. And the Department of Justice will also acknowledge that. They say that they went into departments that had a pattern of constitutional violations or where they received complaints. It's not necessarily the worst of the worst. And so it's hard to say, well, New Orleans, which was one of the police departments that actually was struggling, and from what I understand, you know, still continues to struggle with morale in the police department, particularly now that they are being investigated by the Department of Justice. And so I think that that's somewhat of a misnomer, that thinking that these departments are the worst. But I do think that a lot of police departments, one of the first things that happens when you do get investigated by the Justice Department is there is a morale level. As one union guy said to me, he says, who wants to go work for a police department that's being under a cloud for the next 4, 5, 10 years? Who wants to work there?
So for, is that part of the reason why these reforms drag on for years and years and years? Because they result, the implementation of these reforms result in turnover, and that slows down the progress of the reforms themselves?
Absolutely. And when you look at these reforms, I find it quite interesting, although it's very wonky. But, you know, one police reform could have essentially 300 things that this police department has to do. So you could have police department A, over the course of 4 years, you need to do these 300 things. Well, the federal monitor is writing reports, you know, sometimes twice a year, sometimes four times a year, saying where you are on those 300 things every single year for those 4 years. So if you're in year three and you've only accomplished 150 of those items, guess what? You're going to be in this for the long haul. One of the things that I ended up finding in my investigation was that none of the police departments actually completed their reforms during the time period that they thought it was going to take. You know, and these others, too, they had doubled. And with the increase in time is the increase in cost. And these are not – these are very expensive reform processes. So to answer your question, yes, a lot of these reforms, none of them completed on time, the ones that had set up a timetable with the Department of Justice. Secondly, one of the things that elongates the process is resistance. You know, when the Department of Justice comes in, you know, the police officers are being told very explicitly what they're doing wrong and how they should be corrected. And there is a view by some folks that, you know, the federal government's coming in and being very big brother and telling us how we're supposed to change this police department. We know this neighborhood. We know crime in the area. And so sometimes you see that resistance with police departments who finish closer to their timetable. One of the things that I've heard more often is that they accepted Department of Justice findings earlier, and they just decided, we're going to make these changes. For departments that the process took longer, they said sometimes it was a fight 1, 2, or 3 years before the Department of Justice and the police leaders could get on the same page and the unions and say, okay, now let's move forward.
One complaint about federal interventions into police operations is that they target policies and procedures and not personnel. And that sometimes leaves, I guess, bad apples on the force. But are those bad apples neutered by the new policies and procedures?
I mean, I would actually disagree with that. I think that there's policy procedures and it addresses personnel through other measures. I just did a story came out, I believe, last month about early intervention systems, which is something that you will regularly see the Department of Justice, particularly in recent investigations, ask police departments to implement. And essentially, that addresses the personnel issue, that along with other measures. So, yes, these investigations absolutely address personnel, but you may be looking at it because they're actually putting in place a system. So an early intervention system or early warning system, as they used to be called, is essentially a database that keeps track of officer behavior. And the idea is that if an officer has been disciplined or has some personnel history, it's included in this database. And it's, you know, I consider it like the artificial intelligence. When an officer hits a certain threshold for maybe use of force or you handcuffed people too many times, you missed too many court dates, you took too many sick days, you can get flagged in the system. And so when you get flagged, a supervisor is required to look at that and see if there's a problem. And so the idea that these early warning systems are kind of a heads up for police departments of who may be on the path toward future misconduct or future bad behavior. So the idea is that these systems will help alert authorities so that they can correct the behavior. It's not necessarily going to be a disciplinary measure, and it's supposed to not be focused on the discipline aspect, but really curbing potentially problematic behavior for the future.
We have about a minute and a half left, and I know that you and a colleague at the Post looked into CMPD. What did you find about how they operate?
I wish I had been prepared more specifically about CMPD because we looked at so many police departments, but I would encourage people to actually go to the Washington Post. We included all the information about each of the departments that we investigated at WashingtonPost.com.
Okay.
And look up the story.
And finally, the police departments that are under mandates by the Justice Department, and we only have about 30 seconds left, but those departments have to put these reforms into place, and they have a certain amount of time to do so, and as you said, they sometimes go overtime. But when that happens, they are no longer under a mandate. They're no longer under supervision. Is it sustainable once the Justice Department looks the other way?
That's an excellent question because the Department of Justice never comes back and says, hey, 5 years later, is this working? And they've acknowledged that in the stories, and they've acknowledged that to us. And so we don't know. The only department that I know that has actually done a comprehensive look was the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C., and they just got their findings back this year. But yes, that is a huge and gaping hole with these investigations, is that there is rarely a point in which these departments stop years later, take a look back and say, did these reforms that we put in place, did all this money that we spent, did it actually work?
Kimberly Kelly is part of the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative team at the Washington Post who looked into police departments around the country. And as she just told us, you can find out even more about that and about the CMPD because they looked into them too at WashingtonPost.com. Kimberly, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.